Okay, now we are going to start the English medium discussion, and we have about an hour. So before going to our traditional and assigned sutta, if anyone is having any question or any topic or any interview reports, we can take a few minutes. Adi.
Sorry, Bhante, we have not received any report for this session, Bhante.
So, we can, straightforward, we can go to the Sutta Nipata. So, I invite Venerable Buddharakhita to continue, please. Last time we went up to the fourth.
Okay, I'll just go back over the fifth because it's connected into the sixth. These disputes have arisen amongst ascetics. In relation to them, one becomes elated and dejected. Having seen this too, one should desist from arguments, for there is no other benefit than praise and gain. If, however, he is praised there, having declared his doctrine in the midst of the assembly, he is thrilled by this and swells with pride. Having obtained the benefit that accords with his wish. So here again, the Buddha has really picked up on this line of how pride or arrogance or conceit are all the through line for the nourishment for a debater or for somebody who's argumentative. So if again we think about these commentators or people on television, we should watch out for the hints of a certain pride in their character. And we should understand that, pride is a naturally occurring mental phenomena. And if we don't have manageability over our pride, it can lead us into all kinds of trouble. And I would say that there's a healthy kind of a pride. And there's an unhealthy pride. So like a healthy pride would be that, you do a good job or you do well in your school or in your exams, and you can acknowledge that you've done a good job. You can feel a sort of happiness or a contentment or a pride in one's job being done up to the mark or accomplished. Whereas the pride we're talking about here is a kind of a toxic pride, one of a tone of superiority or better than. So this is very much ego-driven and supportive of the development of a sense of atta or conceitedness or self. And this is not beneficial. So we should distinguish between the different qualities and aspects of what I would call healthy pride and unhealthy pride. So normally we view pride as one of the great evils or sins. And so a lot of people have a false pride. They have a pride that's like they diminish their achievements in life, or they have an inferiority about whatever they have accomplished. But there's a healthy pride of where one can just simply take one's credit for, meritorious deeds and just move on. And it doesn't hang onto one. One isn't inferior or superior. So we need to see pride in these negative aspects as well, of feeling inferior about something, where one one denies one's achievement. There's a false modesty to it. And this too is a form of pride. It's a pride where a negative pride, meaning a one where one gives a false self-evaluation. And then one feels diminished. And supposing you've achieved, well in life, but you have this air of humility about you, and then somebody says, they seem to put you down. Well, you're obviously not very special in life, and then you feel hurt by that, and then maybe you're angry about it. You feel that you've been snubbed, or you feel you've been made to be feel inferior. And in your mind, you're thinking, I'm humble. I'm a modest kind of person. And this person has put me down. And I don't deserve that. You know, in fact, I'm a person of accomplishment. So here again, we see this sort of tricky nature of pride playing out its role. Whereas, you know, we're not better than, we're not equal to, or we're not the same as, but we are different. So we can sort of take a compliment and just move on. We can take it as an acknowledgement and move on. Recently, I was visiting Ireland and somebody described me. They said, oh, you're not like the Dalai Lama. It was a kind of an insult. And I said, yeah, it's true. I'm not actually like the Dalai Lama. I'm a Theravada monk. You know, he's a Tibetan monk. So we wear different clothes and style. And, you know, I was able to acknowledge the insult, you know, as true. So I had a certain self-dignity about myself, whereas the person was actually trying to put me down in a way. And, you know, we're not here to be superior and we're not here to be inferior. So we need to understand the nature of pride and how it comes out. And we have to understand if we have a false humility, then we're already priming ourselves to be hurt or insulted later on by somebody who we perceive as superior to us. So it's this misjudgment or misassessment. And one of the key ways that we know that we're falling into this trap is because of shame, a sense of shame. And when there's shame, there's always going to be this sort of unhealthy pride. And again, here in this sutta, the Buddha is referring to an unhealthy pride, where somebody has to kind of boost themselves up and put themselves out there like that they're very knowledgeable or very smart or very sophisticated. And they're actually setting themselves up for their own downfall again, because, you know, if somebody is smart enough to see through their arguments, then they'll be defeated and dejected and depressed. So just to read that verse out again. If, however, he is praised there, having declared his doctrine in the midst of the assembly, he is thrilled by this and swells with pride, having obtained the benefit that accords with his wish. So maybe we can listen to what Mahatero has to say about number 6.
This is not the same thing we took yesterday, last time. We finished at 5th, isn't it?
Yeah,
this is the 6th. Yeah. So this is talking about something positive. Pasansito va phanatatta hoti akkhaya vadam parisaya majje. Sotang hasati uttamatichatena pappuya tamattang yatamano ahu. If anyone is phrased by his own belief, his view, declaring the same among the other many people, then he feel I got it, and then he celebrated, and then be proud. So this is the way. That is the only motivation we know. That is what we are fighting throughout the life, and so this is being very. This being very spiritual thing in India. Indian, some sages, some gurus, all of a sudden appear, and people phrase like God, almost God. And they are making such the movements, and ultimately he disappears. Such people can't face with insult or any defeat or nothing. They are immediately disappearing. And the West started the Pope. Pope is God. Whatever the Pope is telling, no questioning. Ultimately, all the wealth come into the Pope and war crimes and the cross, the Holy Cross Wars, everything started. So we have enough literature. Therefore, whenever someone is spiritually advancing, one has to be, we have to have the equal, how do you call, sub-brahmachari, co-meditators. They must give their impression. And that is much, much important than the majority's popular expression. And therefore, the Buddha says, Kalyanamitta is the only thing, and it will take 100%. You have to have a noble friend. You have to have a true person. Not praising, not putting you down. But it's very difficult. Upanishad Sahita found a very direct answer for that. If you are a true friend, if you are a true person, if you are a noble person, you will find enough noble person outside. If you are free, true to you, if you are true to type, and if you are noble to yourself, you find others. But if you are not true, if you are not open to yourself and noble, not true, not noble, not true, not noble, you find everyone is suspicious outside. So therefore you have the self-empathy, self-sympathy, and that is what we do. We sit comfortably. We just sit comfortably and say, yes, I am sitting here now. And we just walk and make sure this is verifiable. Whatever phrase coming, we don't know whether he's cheating us, putting us on a pedestal and start whitewashing. We don't know. And that is what every time happened in the religious circles. But we are not that. Of course, it is good thing to have a phrase and all the kind of thing. But it's not lasting. So I am observing the world for 40 years now, and how quickly people coming as spiritual masters, and so much of media coverage and all the kind of thing. And then another person come next, the other older person gone, dead and gone, finished. So how long we have to observe it? I think it's a lifelong. Throughout, you have to be humble, you have to true to type, have a maybe few, but true people, noble people, don't believe the world is lacking the true people and the world, religious, the noble people, they are. But majority we select those who are praising us and cheap popularity, and you become cheap and the popularity will be increased and not a lot of numbers, but no quality. So therefore I am so happy about Pandita Sayadaw and Venerable Jnanarama. They set role models. Upanishad is like a lion. He is going forward and doing. Venerable Jnanarama is like a tusker. Just be in the forest. But both are the same. They create a new vibration. And they don't say that good people are lacking or missing in the world. They say there are. They will come if you maintain true type, if you maintain the noble type, they will come. And if you stay in Nisarnamani and see, every person come here is good. Very rarely a bad person happens. And they also leave it. But if you go out, very, very difficult to find a good person. I heard a story, Hindu people can tell, and the Hindu master, maybe father, sent two children to find the worst person on the earth, there's nothing good. The other person went and searched, the best person you find, nothing wrong. So the person who is searching a bad people go to the brothels and the taverns and everywhere, see what is the worst kind. No, every worst person having some good qualities. So he come and report to the father, I am sorry, there are no such completely wrong people. And the other person went and searched among the noble people, they are utterly dirty, rogues behind robes. And he come and says, I am sorry that I went to the old, what you call the noble societies and found, no one is noble. And the interpreter is the private school headmaster, he says, there's a common sense, if you go and see, in the worst places, you will get discouraged because you are going to that place with your prepared mind. you go with your the set of mindset, so you will never see the truth. If you go to good places and search for a good person, not. But sometimes the worst place, you may find a good person. In the best place, you may find the worst person. But that is what happened in the present-day science. Everyone is proposal writing and they are going to the research with the preconceived idea. So they see what they want, that they wish to see. And that is what you call the quantum physics. If your mind is set to look into that, you will see it. So quantum physics says that the smallest particle have two qualities, the velocity and the weight. If your machine is set to see the velocity, you can't see the weight. If I settle the machine to see the weight, you can see this thing. And come together in an inferential way, in a deductive way. Both the qualities you can't see. Because your mind is fixed to see the velocity. You never see the atomic weight. So we are such a conditioned people. So therefore, phrase and the lost or ill fame. So if we have a relationship other than the pure Dhamma, I will consider him as a good. So I don't like anyone to find fault with him. But I have rejected him as good. That's the way. So Upanishad side says, if you once become you become a friend to yourself, if you are true to type and noble, for so much of that is why the Mahayana idea, dog has the Buddha nature. Have you heard about? Dog has dog nature, that is Buddha nature. But if you say that to the Theravada people, they will be so angry. How can you find the Buddha nature in dogs? Dog has dog nature. So when you become true to type, your natural expression, natural outcome, you are a simply good man. Even the Karl Marx says, human, they are good, but due to the class system, they become bad. Isaac Newton says, when something is traveling on the space, it's always straight, unless otherwise something come and hit you. The Buddha says, everyone's mind is glisterous and bright. But it's smeared by the outer layer. So don't look at the outer layer. Go in. So all of them understand the nature, the beginning is always pure. But we never see, we see all the attributions. So therefore fame and this thing are the guided line for us to select our good things, but always it is not leading you, because unless otherwise you have a choiceless awareness. Unless you have evenly suspended attention, you are already with scripts. You are looking at people with your mind with the scripts, mind with preconceived ideas, mind with the prepared, that means conditioning. But that condition not so poisonous if you know about it. Yes, I am with a good idea with him, I am with a bad idea with him. Then if I know, I can directly tell him and says, please don't let that be smeared with, I have a bad feeling about you. I have a good feeling about you, no problem. That world says no. You must tell directly, because then there will be a divorce. Married people can't tell directly you are good or bad. Then, yes, good you can say, but bad, no. So what a way of world. So therefore the Buddha says, anindito, natti loke anindito. There's no person on the earth underwent through that ill fame. Everyone. Buddha is the worst cases. Planned the tarnishing. But he never considers. Gami aranye sukadukha putto nevattana nocha parandaheya pusanti passa upadim paticca nirupadim kena pusayyung passa. That's the one place where earlier it was with the other ascetics. They were really getting the fame and gain and everything. Ultimately, Buddha's disciple went there. All the fame and gain came to the Buddhist disciples. And they were angry. They said, some thugs in the street, whenever someone is coming, a Buddhist disciple coming on Pindapatha, insult with filthy language. So ultimately they start insulting Buddha also. So Venerable Ananda goes to Buddha and says, Bhante, shall we shift into another place? Buddha is not necessary. Again the Venerable Ananda make another appeal. Not necessary. Third time he says, Bhante, whenever we go out, so much of insult, not only for us, even for you. Then the Buddha says, stay 7 days. Let it subside. And if you go to other place, that place also, if going to start, what are you going to do? And then he says, Kame aranye sukha dukkha putto. Whether you are living in the forest or in the village, you will be smeared by the phrase and gain, phrase and ill phrase, ill fame, and gain and lost. Kame aranye sukha dukkha putto, nevatana nocha parandahe. Don't think it is due to me or it is due to other people. Dhammata. Pusanti patha upadimpaticha. They come and touch you according to your liking and disliking. Your mental configuration. It become a fame or it become a ill fame according to your judgment. So therefore, nirupadinkena pusayyum patha. If you don't have, or if you have a choiceless awareness, what fame? What gain? What lost? If you have liking and dislike, accordingly other person can program you. Pusanti passa upadim paticca, nirupadim kena pusayyum passa. So Buddha set an example and gave admonishment to Venerable Ananda. 7 days time everything disappeared. Because daily you can't pay people to for blackguard Buddhist monks. 7 days. But usual commoners, very difficult because they are living on pride. Therefore, Mahabharata says, the people living in pride, proud, no? Pride or proud?
Pride.
The ill fame is worse than the death. If you are a person concerned, always has a pride, and someone come and insult, it is more than the death. Their life is depend on this thing. So therefore people are paying and doing anything to have this. That is what the information technology and artificial intelligence, social media manipulate you. Because each and everyone is behind this pride. But when you are a meditator, going to the forest, when you become here now, why I am, that comparison loses the power. That happens only when two people interact. That's called social. That's become ethical. You are not ethical when you are isolated. That's why the Buddha says, first foremost, go to the forest, sit under a tree and go to a solitude place. Let others send kites, no problem. Be mindful and mind your own business. So this is the very harsh way of telling the same thing. So that is what I have to add. If there are no other comments, I will invite Venerable to go forward.
So the seventh is, though his pride is the ground of distress, he yet speaks from conceit and arrogance. Having seen through this too, one should not dispute, for the skilled say this doesn't bring purity. So here the Buddha is making a point towards somebody who might be involved in an argument with this argumenter. So if I see the conceit and arrogance of this debater, then and I see through it, I see that this person is indeed kind of fragile and that it's just their pride, and I can sort of destroy them by attacking their pride, deflating them. The Buddha cautions us here not to dispute, for the skilled say that this doesn't bring purity, because in this case I'm just trying to win a point. I'm not actually doing things for the benefit of the other person or for myself. I'm just making a cheap score, and I'm cheapening the debate. So I've moved the target from a kind of a search for truth to just a domineering and a kind of point winning. So again, like this through line of the vulnerability of pride. As being the ground for distress. So sometimes when we're in a situation and we do feel distress, we should look around for our prideful nature. And we should understand that, you know, sometimes people are just picking holes with us. They haven't actually found a genuine argument with us. They are just they're just trying to attack us on the ground of pride. So this happens both ways, as I've mentioned in the previous verse, that one can have a pride of being superior or a pride of being inferior. And you see this in these extremes. It's a little bit harder to see the pride of delusion because in that pride, people just reduce everything to, well, we're all the same. And like this kind of an idea that we're all the same is also, again, a false idea. And they can say things to you like, well, we're all the same. We're all family. We're all this. We're all that. We're all the one. We're all under the one envelope. We're all under the one God. And they diminish the individuality and the difference. So again, this kind of strategy is very common in Hinduism, where they will subordinate Buddhism as being a kind of a branch of Hinduism and say, well, we're all the same. Sometimes I go to these interfaith things, and then they'll say we're all God's children, where they don't really know that Buddhism doesn't have a God, so we're not really part of God's children. And so this is a kind of the deluded form, and it doesn't appear like a form of pride, but the superiority and the inferiority are much more grounded into this sense of pride. It can be very hard to point out or argue with somebody who is very deluded that that we're not all the same, because they think that they're being friendly or inclusive when it's not. So they're diminishing the individuality or the distinct nature between of people. So whereas the superior form of pride or the inferior form of pride is focused on these qualities of the individual. And one is easy to attack in that way because of their conceit or arrogance. So the person who is feeling inferior is in arrogant that I'm so humble. And the superior, the puffed up person is again arrogant that I'm inferior, I know better than you. So both of them are deluded in the nature that that I know better than you, or that I'm more humble than you. And this is kind of leading to this empty lack of true sense of self-strength. And that's why they are easy to have victory over in this kind of points war. But the Buddha cautions us to not abuse our knowledge or our insight into the underlying nature of a person's pride, and says to us to not score points. For the skills say this does not bring purity. So we may win the score, the point over the other person, and they feel humiliated or upset and, you know, flustered. But to another person listening in the audience, they will realize that we've just scored a cheap point. Anyway, maybe Mahatero has something to add.
Yes, no, nothing special, because it's just the continuation of the same, special on the pride side. So someone is getting in the discussion or in argumenting, he's winning, and if he's become proud, the Buddha is always thinking, not let that curse disturb him. Buddha is thinking, how can I rescue him? So that is the part missing in the other religions. Buddha never let them perish through his pride. Like he says, now he is in trouble. I am also part and parcel. He is in trouble because he is with the one-upmanship. So he is always thinking, how can I let him know? How can I rescue him? So that is what the Purusha Dhamma Sarathi He is not only tackling the other person, but leading after that. Purusa Dhamma means tackling the person. Sarathi means later he is leading. So his understanding is very important. Buddha's understanding is important that you won the game. And then Buddha knows now he is in trouble. This is Ya Unnati Sasa Vighata Bhumi. Anyone who is get the high upper hand, it's a Vighata Bhumi. It's a distraction. It's a lot of trouble for him now. Because of his winning nature. So Buddha is not perish yourself with your pride, no. He thinks, how can I rescue him? How can I let him know? So it has to mark time. While now he's in the upper mental situation, Buddha never go and interfere with him. So let it happen and then he says, hey, I am another party, you win the game, never mind. But it's my duty to lead you. So therefore the noble, Olympic Games and the Buddha's game is different. This always thinking with the kind of a compassion, kind of a leader, Sarathi, and it's everywhere. There only the one person the Buddha was not happy is the Mahasachaka. Sachaka is the Shakyan clan, but it is still low caste. And he is not Shakyan clan, he is low caste, but he is teaching all the princes. And everyone is very happy and he is very good arguing and says, the Buddha is still in no self. He is foolish. I can win him. So go with 500 princes and go and tell Buddha, if I wish I can go to the north, if I go, I can go to the east. And then why are you telling that I have no soul? I can. Then Buddha says, the argument is his face is very ugly. So can you change your face? You can do anything, but he's a very fat, putting a iron belt to keep the belly. And he said, can you make yourself beautiful? So he lost. And all the 500 disciples came harassing him. I will argue till the Buddha gets wet. With the Buddha get agitated, Buddha ultimately removes the robe and says, I am not sweating. You are the one sweating. You are the one dying there. But he never get enlightened. So proud. And the story says, he later became a monk in Sri Lanka, in Kaludhya Pokuna, and he gave the interpretation for Kalaka Rama Sutta. It was so bright. The king was listening at the periphery, at the level, and ultimately king offered the whole Sri Lanka to that monk, telling Bhante, what we know being kings, nothing, according to your knowledge, therefore I listen to your Dhamma standing all night. This is such a good interpretation about Kalaka Rama Sutta. And our commentator says he is the Buddha's time Sachaka. But he never got enlightened at that level. He's a sharp fellow, but still he was not happy to accept the defeat. But he got the point, and after so much of 100 years, came to Sri Lanka and gave Kalaka Rama Sutta. It seems that till that there were no commentaries on Kalaka Rama Sutta. And that is what Venerable Jnanananda translated as magic of the mind. This life he would have got enlightened. But at that time, Buddha was not able to send him to the other shore. Even he got the point. So otherwise that Ya Unnati Sasa Vighata Bhumi. Vighata means it's full of troubles. So therefore you have to take care about him. Because he definitely go with and shouting and all the kind of thing, ask him for trouble. So if he is going to the ignoble people, he will suffer a lot. So Buddha is always covering behind. So that is the real leadership or spiritual leadership. Buddha never defeat someone and smash him. Some of the other let him take it, let it happen, lesson for him. And that is very important in encounters with Buddhism. Buddha is always not just defeating and let him perish. Not him be proud and perish. He just tackle the case afterward. This is what the Purusa Dhamma Sarathi. Manati mana vadete paneso. Evampi diso ana vivadayeta. Nahitena suddhin kusala vadanti. Therefore, knowing these things, don't debate, don't argue. By arguing, you never get purified. But present day media is always like that. Election debates, and this debate and that debate. So people are so happy because people wanted to have the cockfights, bullfights, the animal fights. So now human fights. Fighting in front of the stage and people are looking. So therefore, nahitena suddhin kusala vadanti, there is no purification. Purification of the mind happens when the mind stops, when the mindfulness comes. So it is very difficult. Even the purification happen, the very meditator do not know how to appreciate it. Very meditator do not know this is a sign of purification. They consider it as a decasting, or boredom, or monotony. Because they are not meditating for purification. They are meditating for other trivial things. So it is basically, and Upandita says, it's 100% mistake of the teacher. Teacher must understand that. By understanding, he must let him know. Otherwise, disciple is very good, he is practicing, regular practice. But whenever purification happens, may he misread it. So teacher has to prepare parables, examples, and just say, this is the way our mind is cheating, so therefore you are on the correct path. Have faith, don't doubt, go out like that. So he wrote a yellow book, Upandita Saido, and I translated that into Sinhala. I gave it to him and many can't understand it. But Pandita Saido says, I try to keep you people aware while you are meditating. This kind of upakilesa can happen. You must have preparedness to interpret it in a proper way. And for the last 40 years, especially last 20 years, I find that kind of awakening happen among people. In the religious circle, we can tell them, this is what happened, so therefore corona is good. The economic regression is good. The suffering is good. Because you have to think, anew. So therefore, whatever you suffered is good. Now you have ways and means to get out. Luxury is no good. Winning, no good. Because it make you a metta, that means an idiot. No mindful, not ever diligent. So therefore, it's a kind of riding the wave. It's a kind of understanding the suffering. So the point I made is, even the other person is winning and he is proud, he's in trouble. You are responsible. You are responsible. You have to let him know. You have to indicate him, hey darling, maybe I am a part and parcel of the game. So therefore, I have to find the ways and means to correct him. No any other comments? So then we are proceeding.
So the eighth verse is just as a hero nourished on the king's food comes thundering, desiring an opponent, rush off in his direction, Sura. Already in the past, there was no scope for a fight. So here, it's pointed out that the analogy between good food is strengthening. If one is nourished by one's pride, one goes rushing forth, emboldened, like you're strengthened, looking for a rival, looking for somebody else that you can argue or fight with, because your pride is the nourishment. So this this idea of healthy nourishment or unhealthy nourishment, or we are what we eat or something like that, is very recurring idea in the Buddha's teachings, like this idea of bojanga or bojana, what is nutrition. And there's even a chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya on nutrition, and it's something I think a lot about. Am I nourishing myself in a healthy or an unhealthy way? And what is nourishing for me? And finding things that are beneficial and nourishing in a beneficial way. So years ago, when I was, I've lived in Asia with the last 25 over years. So I started to have stomach troubles and so on, maybe about 20 years ago. And I would go to the Ayurvedic doctors, and they would make recommendations and say, well, this is suitable food and this is not suitable food. And it was very difficult initially, because to get used to this diet of not eating things that are not suitable, because I would... I would like to eat muruku and just go through all the spicy things, and then having an Ayurvedic doctor telling me that that these spicy things were not suitable for my pitta nature, so that it was aggravating and it was the basis of my ill health. So if we say to somebody who enjoys debating that that their nutrition is pride, and that it will be not healthy for them, when it has empowered them, it has made them like he says here, a person fed on king's food that has been strengthened so much and feels empowered to go look for another rival. The same with pride, it becomes like a kind of a king's food, where one feels very supercharged and ready to battle and debate with anybody and everybody. And you sometimes see this with people. They come in meditation and they get very excited about the Dhamma, and then they want to go around like missionaries and explaining the Dhamma to everybody who they come across, whether they want to hear it or not. And it's very tedious, and then they're upset later on if somebody has a point or counterpoint or an argument that they don't have a good sort of this point to counter argument. So we have to realize that this is kind of the nature of the mind. And it's an interesting quality, where people will say, well, that doesn't make sense, or that makes sense, or that's rational, or that's not rational. Whereas like the wisdom is feeding on the way the world is. So you might have an opinion about this sutta that, well, pride is not so important, what the monks are talking about here is not relevant, but that's a kind of that can be a failure to look at the world and see the world as it really is. Like sometimes we're just caught up in our own ideas about how the world is or isn't. As Mahatera was saying earlier on, we assume that there is no good in so-called bad places, and we assume that there is only good in good places, but it's not true. And it is the role of wisdom to see things as they really are. And this not arguing with the world, not arguing with nature, is a very important quality of wisdom. So I would also say this aspect of nutrition is very important, and carefully taking in the right kind of food. And I don't just mean this in terms of edible food, but whatever is nutritious for one's own mind, so that we're neither impoverished or too ascetic, or that we're too indulgent. So this goes back to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where we avoid the extremes and we take the middle way. So again, as a monk, I find that sometimes I find some monks and other people that I meet in the religious life are extremely ascetic and live very poor and wretched. And sometimes I say to them, like, what is your nutrition? What is wholesome? What is beneficial for you? And if it's just always coarse food or always coarse, very impoverished kind of life, then you wonder if they have missed the middle way. And you know, the middle way is sometimes where we eat food that is suitable and beneficial for our health. So again, when I come back to these Ayurvedic doctors, you know, they encouraged me to eat more sweet food, that I was eating too much bitter or astringent food, and that, you know, that some of the food I was eating was too coarse. If you know a lot of, you know, this kind of organic food or Western ideas about, you know, healthy natural food can be too, quite rough, quite coarse kind of food, like brown rice instead of white rice. And I need to eat food that is easy to digest rather than something that is coarse or rough. So I had to really readjust a lot of my so-called thinking about what was suitable nutrition and find what was suitable and beneficial that was not indulgent on the one hand and not too ascetic on the other hand, and keep a middle way in what was suitable in my food. So this idea of food, eating the wrong kind of food, in this case, a debater eats pride as a form of food, then that's a very unhealthy type of food that will bring one to one's downfall. So maybe Mahatero has something else to say about that one.
No, number talking,
number 8. Well, one other time that the Buddha mentioned this kind of idea of food, he was walking on Pindapat and he went through a village and he received no food in that village. And then he reflected after going through the village and he realized that Mara had been blocking people from making the donation of food to the Buddha. So the Buddha said, "Oh, I see you, Mara." And Mara says, "How do you like to be hungry?" And he said, "I am an eater of joy." So, you know, he wasn't going to eat the pain of hunger. He was going to eat the joy of maintaining his vinaya. And so sometimes I don't get offered food, you know, especially when I'm in the West. I can go long periods of time. I don't get what is you know, food suitable or time, and I have to fast. And sometimes people don't really get the message that we're fasting as monks, but I eat joy instead. The last time I was traveling back to Ireland, I told my friend who was picking me up from the airport, I said, "Look, because of the time difference coming from Sri Lanka to Ireland, you know, I think it'll be more than 30 hours since I ate last." So I said, "Look, I'll be quite hungry and I need a substantial meal." So he said, "Oh, I'll bring you to McDonald's." And I said, "Okay, you know, no problem. But you need to understand that I need maybe 3 McDonald's meals." Not what Mr. McDonald thinks is a meal. I need about 3 of those. You know, that I need something substantial. So for some reason, he didn't bring me to McDonald's. He brought me to his mother's house, who's very old. She's an old friend of mine, and she's a wonderful cook, but she's 88, and she wasn't ready. And he hadn't prepared her. So we walked in the door, and in the morning, you know, this is like at 10:30 in the morning, and she said, "Okay, I can make you some eggs." And I said, "Fine." And she said, "Well, I make you 2 eggs." And I said, "Well, maybe you can make me 4. And then she said, "I'll make you some toast." And she gave me 2 pieces of toast. And she said, "Would you like something else?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like 2 more toast." And then I had 2 more toast. And then she said, "Would you like something more?" I said, "Yeah, I'll have 2 more to toast again." And so, you know, this was the meal I had after 30 hours, and then I would fast again another 24 hours until the next day. So, but I always reflect on my vinaya at this point, like, and I reflect on that story I told you about the Buddha, that we are eaters of joy. And though it's, you know, in Ireland, like, people just don't fast. Nobody fasts anymore. Nobody has self-restraint. Everybody has abundance, and nobody has gone hungry in a long, long time. So it's unimaginable that somebody has not eaten in 30 hours and will not eat again for another 24 hours. So, you know, more than 50 hours, this little meal had to carry me along. So I always reflect on that statement, I'm an eater of joy. And there are many things we can eat, you know, in the world. And it's not just carbohydrate and protein, but we can eat joy and we can eat pride. So we need to be very careful, like I said, between healthy pride and unhealthy pride. A good sort of healthy sense of self or an unhealthy sense of self. And this idea of nutrition is a very central idea in the Buddhist teachings.
The same thing happened to me in America also. I mean, they are very, very concerned about monks. But they don't know how to treat. And they heard that I am vegetarian, so they never add any protein. No any protein. And give very little and far away sitting and talking. So, one meal a day, 3 days consecutively. And evening also, they don't know how to make gilampasa, nothing. So, some or the other message came to Sri Lanka. I tried to not to keep, but they were so unhappy because they have abundance. But they don't know how to offer. So, I mean, we would have done some bad karma, karmic forces earlier. I'm full of meals, but the times and the other things make restraint. And so I decided to not to visit temples. But their behavior is different. So when I go there, we are coming like a different people, have some restraint. So, but if you go to a lay people and living in outside, we have some kind of a command and demand. Otherwise not. So therefore, when you are traveling, you have to know how to eat pleasure, how to eat piti, and maintain yourself like a camel. If there is no water, so you have to some or the other manage it. But the way the communication happened, ultimately the dayaka become very regretful. Sometimes they make a normal meal packet. So it is enough for dessert, not for the main meal. Main meal, we may eat him 3 times of that to manage it. And recently I found if you have diabetes, you must not skip a meal. You must have little meals whole day, so easy. No peaks of sugar level, no very low ebb. But we are naturally eating only 1 meal or 2 meals. So therefore maintenance is something different. So if you are, when I go to the hospital, a nutrition came and she gave a talk about how to maintain. And my dayaka was there, you go to the hell. He's a monk. He's eating only 1 meal. You can't tell like that. Have you ever been hungry? Never. You go wrap up your nutrition food and get out. And she was so upset. She was paid. The other person was telling very harsh, of course. And he says, don't come and understand. He's a forest monk. He's living only 1 meal or morning only. So how can you talk about getting a full meal in there for 2 o'clock and get a blood sample? No. But they can't think because they are thinking from that point of view. And they are correct. We must understand not to go to that kind of places and to live in such a place and appear like luxury for our sides. But from their luxury is something different. So therefore, Venerable Guttasila, he was a very senior monk, and he went to New Zealand, and mother do not know how to offer. She prepared everything. This is also for you, this is also for you, this is also for you, this is also for you. She come and goes. Give everything, telling. I mean, it is also enough, Sangika. Make it Sangika. So he says, what to do? And when I go to Chuangian Monastery, they come and offer in their own way. In Burma, they offer in their own way. They know it's a given to Sangha, we can manage. But that way of offering is not the way we do it here. So then, ever questions. The Buddha says you can offer only a weight that one person can lift. Not a heavy load with the four, five people, that offering is no good. And that's a way of offering, and the time dimension. And some people are vegan, some people are vegetarian, and Chinese people never eat even onion. Red onion, garlic, it's a poison. So these things, so when I go there, there are a few people, they always prepare just chilies and garlic, chilies and onion, make something because we need that kind of spicy. So usually they don't put. But I can manage. I mean, different tastes. And we know it's a Chinese preparation, but they are very, very, very generous. If you say, but at their whole monastery, there are no garlic. There is no medicine because it is restrained. So some people, knowing that, they do compensation. It's bad because the center will be feel inferior. The center can't make our palatable meal packet. But Bintu Bhikkhu Bodhi is asking Dhammaji, what do you feel? Like? You want to have the Nisarnamane way of thing? Or what do you say? And I say, I just follow you. You do, you know Nisarnamane, you know senior monks, whatever you do, I will follow. So he fairly managed with the Chuanyin. I mean, he's the most senior, but behaved like just a simple man. Everyone consider him as a very special person, but he... very humble, so easy for me to go behind him, and that's the way it happens. So when you are traveling, it's a good example. When you are going to especially different cultures, different feeding habits, maybe something special. Anything you have to say?
So this sutra mainly about pride? Is it?
Debating.
It's about debate. But pride is the...
Pride is a cause for... cause for debating.
The cause
for... proximate cause.
Mm. And so that... and pride is like a poison for people. In their... in spiritual practice, that's like poison.
I don't think so. If you know it's a pride, it's a food.
It's food. It's good.
That we are talking and I know. He's inferior, I'm superior. As far as we know, no problem. He's superior, I'm inferior. But ignorance about that make communication problems.
We have to know who's superior, who's inferior.
Not only that. Whenever in-breath happens, you have to understand the in-breath, not the out-breath. When the out-breath happens, you have to understand it's out-breath. Just like he's now talking with the full of pride, proud... pride or proud?
Pride.
So then I have to tell you, okay, your arguments are okay, but mind you are full of pride. And if he's fighting against that, then no debate. You have to accept or reject, understand yes. Then it's a food. Because then and there we understand it. That's what we monks, we don't care whether you are superior or inferior. Whenever it happens, hey, you are trying to be superior, you are trying to be inferior. Just like when the in-breath happens, hey, in-breath, hey, out-breath, no problem.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Gina.
I just wanted to say that the Mahayana is not eating garlic and onions. That's basically because of Indian yogic and yogacara and the belief that like eating garlic and onion is supposed to arise lust. That's the main reason why.
No, in the Vesajjakkhandaka, the Buddha is sometimes loving garlic, sometimes rejecting garlic. Again, loving, they reject. And it go number of times. At last, he says, okay, it is a Ayurvedic medicine. You take it. But the Indian maybe, and Chinese people can say it's a debatable thing, so avoid it. And Mahayana, Theravada people say they are eating meat and everything and kind of, but when you go, they are utterly vegetarian. They are utterly vegetarian, lot of preparations, but not spice. So if they come here, out of bamboo trees, they make so much of things. We don't know. In Burma, bamboo is a luxury. Once a year, all the bamboo shoots are happening. They are making soup and cook meal. I say it's a lot of silica. It's good for purification, I think. And the monkeys, you see, always pulling the bamboo shoots and eat because they are healthy. I think eyesight and others may be good. So, but in Sri Lanka, they don't know. And banana trunk, everything they are using, eating. You know, water buffaloes are eating banana trunk. And they are also the same. They never throw away. But in Sri Lanka also we have. We know the banana, the flower, the end of this thing. And it is a luxury now in Sri Lanka. They make tins and send it to Australia. And they are chasing behind the young jackfruits. And the banana, you know the what that happening at the end of the banana, the flower, unopened area. Full of minor chemicals, very good. So the people know how to make it. So it depends on different places. So you have to understand. Sometimes it appears like the animal protein. No, they are just vegetable. So
that thing about the onions and the garlic again. The Jains don't eat it. So I think it was like a direction within India. So in the Mayana tradition that went through, you know, Pakistan, but Afghanistan.
The Bombay onion is the Bombay. Is it Indian?
Yeah, I know. But, they can have that reaction as well. Like, so if you want Indian food without onion, because they put onion in everything, then you go to the Jain restaurants, you know? Like, no. I know people who can't take onion and garlic, so they go to Jain restaurants. Because it is a kind of an aphrodisiac, or it is entertainment.
Garlic is aphrodisiac.
You know, they put so much onion into it; it dominates the taste. And but anyway, it like just to reiterate his point, it sort of reflects the history of
religious
practices within India. That what got carried into China reflected a kind of a certain time and a certain place and a certain kind of teaching. And a school of Buddhism, you know, such as like also the Theravada tradition is its own time, its own time capsule from an ancient time in Buddhist history. So there was different schools. So sometimes we fail to see that within Theravada, that there was a lot more dynamic sort of schools and practices of the time, which like reflected more ascetic practices or intellectual practices or exchange, you know, between other groups. Whereas like what got cut off here in Sri Lanka is its own like time capsule.
Package.
It's a time capsule of practices. And as you mentioned, we sometimes have to understand the spirit, especially if we travel in the West and meet different different teachers or different people, then we have to understand the underlining rules quite carefully. It's not like sometimes people will think, as a Western monk and I'm traveling in the West, you know, there must be no way I can keep the vinaya. But actually I do. You know, I can travel around the world with no money, fasting and waiting for the dawn. You know, I was flying. I was looking out the window looking for the dawn. You know, I couldn't say what time was the dawn going to be in the airplane. So I have to open the window and look out and so on. And sometimes some of the air hostesses are very accommodating and sometimes they're not.
Not happy.
And sometimes you'll get fed and sometimes you won't get fed. And sometimes you have to be patient with that. And sometimes I'm well treated in some place and sometimes I'm badly treated. In some place, like when I'm in Ireland, like they're very anti-religious at the moment. So I will always get bad treatment.
And, at your hometown?
In my hometown, yes. And so it's, you know, I'll be treated as an alien or as an outsider or...
No, they think we are protesting with their norms.
Yeah.
We are kind of arrogance to look at.
You know, so there's all kinds of... things you have to be patient of. So this idea of what is nutrition and having good nutrition, like feeding on joy, seeing the wholesomeness in what I do, having a healthy sense of pride, if you like, a healthy sense of ego, is very important, because if I'm malnourished, if I'm depriving myself, then I'm just ready to explode. You know, how dare you treat me so roughly, or, you know, what kind of fool are you? Of course I need to eat a lot of food or something like that. And, you know, then you're in trouble. And, you know, that quality of shame, pride is very related to shame, very related to this sense of self, superior or inferior. And that's it's a really at the heart of the business of being a monk.
Okay, now we have to sum up the time up. And there's one book called Buddhism in America. But different traditions are now coming in the same stage. And it's happening very nicely. So it's good for traveling. And when you are traveling, it's like an encyclopedia. Thank you very much for the participation. We are going to sum up the meeting. Kamami kamitabbam.